Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, in the driver's seat, it is me, Brian J. Rowan. The two voices in my ear are Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
Today, we have another double review like we had last week, so we won't have a film topic discussion section. Even though Twitter was alight today, thanks to two pieces of pop culture simulacra that are just going to blow your goddamn minds. First is the news that Channing Tatum, of all people, was cast as the Creole card slinger himself, Gambit, in a solo X-Men film, apparently. We'll see how that goes. I honestly think that's one of the most bizarre casting things I've heard in a while. The other thing was that Zack Snyder, who had teased yesterday, yes, we are recording on Tuesday, had teased on Monday that there was going to be a big reveal of the new Batmobile. And surprise, surprise, today not only did we get the Batmobile, but we got the new Batman costume. Gentlemen, I would like your one-word reaction to the costume, starting with Danny.
Colorful.
Colorful. Hilarious because it was a black and white picture. Nick Newman, one word reaction.
Is whatever sufficient?
Yeah, whatever is perfectly fine.
Whatever.
Whatever. Mine's going to be veiny.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. So we got that out of the way.
Okay.
The movie's not coming out for 2 years, so if anyone at home is like, oh man, I was really hoping they'd be talking more about it, guarantee you that we will.
Are we going to be around in 2 years?
Hey, man. Who knows? Follow us on Twitter in case this goes defunct by then. That's that. So we'll be talking about two small films today. There is Locke, the newest film that stars Tom Hardy. And that is written and directed by Stephen Knight, who did Eastern Promises. So good times there. We'll also be looking at Richard Ayoade's newest film, and that is The Double, which stars Jesse Eisenberg, Mia Wasikowska, and Wallace Shawn. And that's what we're going to do. So no discussion again, sorry. Before we get into that, though, we do have a couple of pieces of housekeeping. First of all, I'd like to thank everyone who's followed us on Twitter. We are currently at 210 followers, which is pretty great. Follow us on Twitter, at @FilmStageShow. We throw out tweets all the time, so you can see past episodes that are newly relevant. You can see different things that people have said about us, and you can tweet back at us. Speaking of tweeting back at us, two things I'd like to talk about. First, we asked on Twitter for you to share some of your most anticipated films of the summer. Someone who is apparently very much in our wheelhouse, Davey M., who is at @Davey_Tony. You wrote in 3, The Congress. 2, Night Moves, also Jesse Eisenberg. Number 1, Boyhood. Honorable mentions, Obvious Child, which I just saw a preview for, and it looks pretty funny. And The Double. So, Davey, I hope you're out there listening, because we're about to tell you what that was like. Also on Twitter, Brandon Isaacson, catching up on @FilmStageShow. Thank you for using that. And glad to say I'm a fan. Loving that I can hear an in-depth review of Ida. So, thank you, Brandon. Glad we could help to sate that hole in your life. And that's that. I also wanted to say that on a personal note, last week we were talking about Blue Tongue Films, the Australian film collective, and I asked if they were named after the lizard. Jordan Raup, our esteemed editor, did not know, so being the fine journalist I am, I tweeted at them, I asked them, and yes, they are named after the lizard. Now, if you're wondering why this matters to me, it's because I actually own a blue-tongued skink, and so now I can happily say that my skink Thelonious has an entire film studio named after him. It's pretty freaking awesome. I know everyone is also wondering, who follows us on Twitter or listened to last week's episode, who the winner of the Touch of Sin Blu-ray is. I can tell you right now that you will find out later. You will also find out how you can win a Blu-ray of the re-release of Fargo, as well as a Blu-ray of Grand Piano. That, along with the winner of the Touch of Sin Blu-ray, will be announced later in the show. So stick around, listen all the way to the end. Good times. No discussion. So let's move into our reviews. The first is Locke. Only Danny and I were able to see this film. Nick, if you have any questions or would like us to clarify any points, feel free to jump in.
Did you guys like it? No. I'll let you get to it.
Thank you.
I wanted to see it very much, but my local, not that anybody needs to know, but just indulge me here. My local theater, really one of the last days I could see it before I went back home for the summer, was showing it at 1 and 3 and then no other time. Which I find very strange. I can't understand what the reasoning behind this might be. But the inconvenient timing of the Jacob Burns Film Center, otherwise a great theater, has left me without Locke. And it's, as David Lynch might say, such a sadness.
That is such a sadness.
Tragedy.
And we'll get into that pretty soon. First, for the plot of Locke, for anyone who doesn't know, this is the newest film that's released by A24. These are the same people who did Enemy and Under the Skin. And I'm pretty much ready to just see what anything they put out.
I think they did Obvious Child.
Yeah, they did. So crazy, crazy, crazy good. The story is of a construction manager who is driving somewhere and is taking phone calls the entire time, basically trying to keep his life from falling apart as he speeds his way towards his final destination. Interesting thing about this film, it was it's pretty much entirely in a car. It is just Tom Hardy, and it is just him taking calls over the stereo system in his car thanks to the wonderful technological brilliance of Bluetooth. And yeah, that's it. It's just him having conversations and driving inexorably towards wherever he's going. I'm going to just say that it's a spoiler to know where he's going. We're gonna give a brief rundown of the movie in its formal and broader narrative strokes, and then we'll get into a spoiler section, at which point Nick will mute his microphone and his headphones, and we will text him when it's time to come back. Just like a game show. So Danny King, Locke, what were your expectations and what were your final thoughts on it?
Yeah, well, it is somewhat difficult with this film to clarify a lot of my opinion without delving into plot, but I'll try for this first run through. In general, I really liked the film. My expectation going in was that all I really knew was the conceit of the film, and I knew it had been getting a lot of good buzz, and I'd seen the trailer just in theaters maybe like 3 or 4 times. But the trailer gives you a sense of the movie's visual style, but it doesn't really clarify anything about what's going on in the film. So before I saw it, I had no idea what the plot was or what Tom Hardy's character does for a living. So I think when I first heard of the film and it's called Locke and it's set in a car, I just assumed it was kind of like the suspense thriller where he might be, I don't know, some kind of agent or something like that. And so when the movie turned out to be completely different, I was sort of taken aback by it and kind of charmed by it. And I won't talk about the plot, but I think I can at least mention what his character does for a living, because it's kind of like in the opening shot. So he's just this like construction foreman who is obsessed with cement. And one of my favorite things about the film is how much detail it goes into how you have to like prepare a cement pour and what that process is like. And it's actually turns out to be like half the movie is just him making phone calls about preparing for this cement pour. And I found it so funny and surprising that it just won me over. And so parts of the movie I just appreciate as a documentary of like what the hell a job like this would be like. And then on a more emotional level, the movie was actually surprisingly kind of heavy-handed and melodramatic. And that was also something that took me by surprise and that I ultimately liked quite a bit. And I think that Tom Hardy is really good in the role. he has a voice that in its own way is kind of as weird as his Bane voice, just kind of in a different register, but it's still pretty fascinating. And so I think the movie kind of foregrounds the artificiality of its conceit, but also follows through on it with a really kind of entertaining story and a nice emotional through line. But that's it for the general thoughts, I guess.
Yeah, my general thoughts trend along the same lines. I was interested to see what they would do with this conceit, and I quite liked it. I will begin by saying that if you are not a fan of overt symbolism in your movies, then you're probably going to hate this film.
Yeah, this is like, so blunt.
This is Mad Men levels of symbolic foregrounding. Not technically a bad thing, though, because just like in Mad Men, I think that the acting and the writing supports that. And it's one of these things where, I mean, the character himself seems to notice. He seems to understand. Once again, bringing it back to Mad Men, there was a scene where they're bringing a computer into the office. I guess, like, very general spoilers for Mad Men. They're bringing a computer into the office, and it's taking up an area that was previously used by the creatives in the office. And the computer's purpose is to help them, like, crunch numbers and work on the media. And someone says to Don Draper, "Don't worry, it's not symbolic of anything." And Don says, "Oh no, it's quite literal." Basically this movie. But it's one of these things where I can't tell you how many times... I do a lot of night driving. I have an active social life that keeps me out on the town until all hours. And there are many times when I've driven home, and I've kind of felt that existential pull of the fact that I'm in the car and life is still going on. And, you know, I've had to take some pretty intense phone calls while driving. And there's this sense of, like, when you're driving and something like that happens, you have two choices. One of them is to stop, and the other is to keep moving. And I've always found that an intrinsically interesting idea. And so seeing it played out in this film spoke to something in me, the writer in me. This is one of those movies that kind of inspires me to want to write more. And Tom Hardy's performance, obviously, if you have a movie like this where he's the only person whose face you see, I mean, he has to be good, and he is. He's fantastic in this. Even some aspects of the movie that I think, again, could trend into parody or overt symbolism, that could just, it could just really blow up a film. But he carries it. He creates and inhabits this character that like really, really easily pulls things off. All the voice acting is really good. And the cinematography, the way that it kind of captures the ethereal nature of driving at night, which is a very strange thing because you're on a roadway, and so you have the lights of the cars and the lights of the roadway itself, and you're not enveloped in the darkness like you are when you're sitting in your room at night. It's very clearly illuminated, but everything's just a little bit wrong. It's all very utilitarian. And it kind of strips away the beauty of the world while still leaving the physicality of it. And this movie somehow makes that utility very, very interesting to look at and beautiful. I was sitting there, and the movie's only... I think both of these movies are only like an hour and a half long. I was sitting there purely transfixed, listening to these conversations and trying to understand what was happening and really finding myself understanding each character just through these very intense conversations that they're having. And Nick, I guess, as you said that you felt a lot in common with the, what's his name, Seligman in Nymphomaniac?
Oh, yeah.
And Llewyn Davis in Inside Llewyn Davis, I found myself really inside of the head of Ivan Locke and understanding him and bonding with him. And so it's one of those films. I feel like if you can see the man and you can grasp what's happening in a very emotional way, and if you give yourself to this idea and really allow the sort of meaning behind the overt symbolism, like don't just look at it as symbolic, but really think about what those symbols mean, it's the type of thing that will grip you the whole way through. And I actually can't wait to see this film again. So spoilers for Locke. What is happening in this film is that Tom Hardy is leaving a construction site where a... What was it? They kept saying it over and over again. the largest single concrete pour outside of nuclear facilities, like nuclear
launch
facilities.
Yeah, something big.
And another great thing is the fact that he is very, Ivan Locke, is very intent on constantly saying the right things or having the facts right. And so he's left that, and he tells everyone the truth. He doesn't try to pull any duplicity or anything, and he doesn't even try to shirk his responsibilities. And what's happening is that he has left that job, that massive job, in the hand of a man who may or may not have a drinking problem and who's never done anything to this size before, so that he can go be there for the birth of a child that he has fathered with a woman that he has a had a one-night stand with 7 months ago. She's got a crisis birth going on. I'm sure that there's a nicer way to say that, but that's what's coming to me right now. And he has to tell his wife this, and he has to try to hold his life together while this is happening, and even, you know, make some assurances to the woman who's about to have his child, all because that's in his mind the right thing to do. You know, he's not just gonna walk away from the site and leave it to go to hell, because he can't do that. But he's also not gonna let this child be brought into the world without a father present, because that is what happened to him, and his father didn't come back till much later, and all he had in him at that point was this anger and disgust. And he's also not gonna lie to his wife. Because he loves her too much, because he believes that if he's upfront and honest that he can fix things. And so he's driving to the hospital, and he is going to make this work. I mean, looking at this film and the things that he's saying, Danny, I mean, do you have any concept of, in your mind, what this film is trying to say in terms of, you know, grappling with this kind of masculine idea? I mean, he's a construction worker and he's a family man, and he talks about honor and doing the right thing and holding the world together, and he actively refuses any outside help to help him with his problems. Do you think that he's being held up as a good symbol, or is he inherently flawed and just kind of lucking into these things, whatever small victories he gets?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I feel like the most, I don't want to say controversial, but the scenes in this movie that most people seem to take objection with are the ones where Locke looks into the rearview mirror of his car and rants to his father, who's dead. And obviously what's weird about them is that they're just completely inorganic to the movie, and they feel very theatrical. And it just seems like something that's a lot less maybe controlled than everything else in the movie. But at the same time, I think it contributes to what you were talking about earlier, about how much access this movie gives you to Locke's emotional state. So the movie kind of ultimately ties all of his behavior to his kind of hatred for his father for not being there for him. And so this decision he's made to be there for the birth of this child jeopardizes his marriage and his career, but he has to do it because it's the one thing that matters to him most. And so I feel like the movie kind of realistically presents that as like a two-sided coin, where on the one hand, that trauma has led him to be a dedicated family man and a really successful employee that always does his work on time and does his work well. But at the same time, it gives him this obsession where in a moment of crisis, like the one he's put in the film, he is willing to risk his whole life just to go after, like the one thing that matters most to him, which is to like avenge his father.
I wouldn't say avenge his father. Yeah, maybe that's piss not on his grave.
To piss on his grave, yeah.
He literally talks about digging him up and making his rotting corpse watch as he is a better man than him.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. And like, I wouldn't say I disliked those scenes even, just because I sort of, maybe by necessity, I just sort of took them as like, okay, this is just him talking in his head, but Knight and Hardy have just made a decision to actually let him act it out. I don't really believe that Locke's actually sitting there talking to his rearview mirror. I think it's sort of a pretty blunt way to just get exposition into the movie.
Yeah.
But I didn't mind it, just because the movie as a whole kind of won me over and surprised me. Like the first line when he calls this woman in a hospital and she says something to the effect of like, have you told your wife you're about to have someone else's baby?
Yeah.
And for me, as someone who had no idea what the plot of this film was going to be, when I heard that line, I was just like, holy shit. Like, this is a really full-blown, intense melodrama. And part of what's cool about the situation of the movie is that it presents this normally very put-together man at, like, the ultimate breaking point of his life where everything's at stake. And he's dealing with it in this space that you described of, like, the nighttime highway where it's almost like he's isolated from the world and he can't quite understand that everything's crashing down around him, but he still knows it. And just the way, I mean, even the way he answers his phone and goes through his list of contacts, a lot of Hardy's behavior just felt so organic. Like he did it a million times and he had it down so well. And like his character, I think even has like a cold. So there's just really nice moments of him like coughing and taking cough medicine.
And for me, I mean, a lot of, like you said, with the woman who calls up and says, you know, does your wife know that someone else is having your baby? I mean, that was an interesting line, because at first I thought it was like, wow, this vindictive bitch. I was like, this, I mean, in my head, I almost felt like they've been cheating and he's a jerk because he's been leading her on and she thinks this is the thing that's going to break up their relationship. But then it turns out that it was one time he basically did it because he was, you know, half drunk and really, really excited that they had just gotten a massive block poured that day in Croydon. And he felt bad. Like, she was a sad woman. He explains her as, like, in her 40s, she'd worried that, like, her chance at happiness of having a child was gone because, I mean, the implication isn't that she's, you know, ugly, but just that she's homely and no one has ever really decided to go for her, and she's shy, and, you know, he really paints this very sympathetic picture of this woman that at the same time she says, do you love me? And his response, and this is when I honestly felt like, oh shit, I'm exactly like this guy. He says, well, that's like a ridiculous question, like I don't know you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I, you know, we don't know each other. Like, how could I love you? And he's very cruelly upfront about it. But there's something noble in the fact that he doesn't lie. But, you know, it's also like he operates on such that male ego and intellect that he's like, well, this should placate this woman who's having issues. And so there were parts of it, like his desire to be there for the child and his openness with her about the situation and his openness with his wife about the situation, where I was like, this is a good man because he's not being deceitful, but he's also a terrible person because he's running roughshod over the emotions of these people. And he seems to think that they should all just be able to shut down the emotional part of their brain and respond in a socially acceptable way.
Yeah.
And it's a little, I mean, it works with the drunk guy because he has authority over him and can speak to him that way because he doesn't have to make an emotional appeal. It does not work with the women who are emotionally tied to him because he just has like abandoned an emotional stake in his life. When his wife says that she read her diary and the night after he came home after cheating on her, just the once, he's very clear that it's only ever happened once. And we don't have a reason to believe him, but I honestly believe him. Like, that's just the kind of man that Hardy has created here.
Yeah.
And the wife says, I read my diary and it says, you know, you came home with the biggest, like, goddamn smile on your face. And she reads that as, he really thinks he's getting one over on us, and he went out and got some strange. And he's like, I don't even remember that. And he could have lied and said, hey, I had a smile on my face because I was so happy to see you again. He doesn't even say that. He's like, well, we just got the block poured. It was a big block. I got it poured. I was really happy about that. He's like, I wasn't even thinking about the fact that I cheated on you with another woman. Which, again, sure, kind of, but... Man, like, really not thinking things through.
Yeah, his obsession with his job is like so, so convincing, and
yeah,
just
and
so much of his behavior.
He's like when his companion Donald, who's a great comedic presence in this film, even if he's just a voice. He says like, you know, I can't do this. I can't get behind the wheel of a car because I've had a couple of ciders, and you want me to go find these three guys who are working on a road somewhere because we have to fix something. And I can't do it. I don't know. Like, I have to think about this. And he's like, no, all you have to do is think about that piece of the sky that we're stealing.
Yeah.
Like, there are so many great lines like that that just give you an insight into this guy. And I really wish I'd been able to watch this movie, like, three times before I could talk about it. Because I feel like every line is loaded in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting because Tom Hardy is such a masculine actor. And the situation, and the way that it would have been shown to us years ago, maybe not even that many years ago, is so, like, stand back, ladies and boys, like, a man is working now. And it's kind of showing you how futile that is in any endeavor that is outside of the physical.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting. It was very interesting. I really like this film, and it's out... I would say I was able to see it without a problem in DC, so I think it's growing, and I think that it's one of those films, like, I'd love to say that we can expect to see Hardy come Oscar season. I'd say he's a lock for a nomination, Hardy.
Yeah,
but I honestly don't know if that's gonna happen, which is kind of a bummer for me.
Yeah, it's such a good performance, and I mean, like you said, you feel like rewatching the film, and I feel similarly, not only because I really liked it, but just because, you know, there are so many moments where he's just small gestures where he's just communicating so much about the character that yeah. feel like they need a second viewing.
And I guess my last statement will be the music was really good, too. I quite enjoyed the score. Any final thoughts from you, Danny?
Yeah, really, really good film. Cement. I wonder if I should pursue a career in that industry now.
Yeah,
clearly.
Just know that when you're doing something this big, C6, that's the
yeah,
next you need.
Not C5.
It's written all over the place. Nick, are you back?
All right, I'm back.
All right, cool. Before we get into our review of The Double, two news items hit Twitter. Just want to shout them out real quick. It's weird. Nothing ever happens on Sundays, so... I've never had to break in for breaking news. The first is that Malik Bendjelloul, the director of Oscar winner Searching for Sugar Man, has been found dead. So that's pretty shocking. I believe he was only, I think, 32. So I'm sure that we'll get news on that as it comes forth. The other big news outside of the frame of human interest and into broader pop culture interest is that apparently it has been announced that the new director of Star Trek III will be Roberto Orci, who we all know is a writer behind some of the biggest movies that have happened in recent years, including The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which we just talked about. And I had some not kind things to say about him and his work. So Twitter's alight. I guess, you know, tweet at us. Let us know what you think about that. And maybe we'll read it on the air next week. Any immediate reaction to either of these stories, gentlemen?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that the death is shocking. I don't think they've released the cause of death yet, but it's just insane.
Yeah. It's always just, I mean, they always, it's their, the way that they always frame it is was found dead, which is just like the most clinical, disturbing way you could put something like that. Also, I just remembered this, H.R. Giger passed away today as well. Designer and artist whose work on Alien has influenced just about every science fiction movie that's come since. So again, it's been a big day. Been a really big day in a bunch of terrible ways. But yeah, I guess moving on from that news, we'll get into our review of The Double, the newest film again by Richard Ayoade. And this again stars Jesse Eisenberg and Mia Wasikowska. And this is the story of a man living in It's a dystopian. I guess it's either parallel dimension slash, you know, post tragedy future. Anyway, it's not in the real world, I guess is the easiest way to put it. Think a little bit about the way that 1984 was presented in the film with John Hurt, and you'll have an idea. And he works in an office where he glides around basically unnoticed by everyone else around him. Unnoticed or met with outright antipathy. Until his exact physical double arrives, who is the opposite of him. Not Milk Toast, not shy. He is, in fact, very charming and charismatic, and he's forceful. I know what some of you at home are thinking. Oh my god, they're reviewing Enemy again. Incorrect.
Different film.
Even though both men live in terrifyingly impersonal apartments, and they have very bleak conversations with their mothers, and they're dealing with their double. Quite a different film. So this is The Double. And Nick Newman, you had really been looking forward to this, and you didn't get a chance to say a goddamn thing during our lock review. So why don't you kick us off? What were you expecting from The Double, and how did it live up to your expectations?
Expectations on this one are a bit hard to qualify, except to say that I was a very big fan of Richard Ayoade's feature debut, Submarine, which was one of my favorite movies of 2011, and is a film that affected me in a really deep personal way, a way that was actually a bit traumatic, almost. And with that in mind, of course, I was looking forward to The Double and being a fan of Jesse Eisenberg as well. The idea of him having a doppelganger film was very exciting. And I think that that much in and of itself kind of sealed it for me. As far as what I was expecting, I mean, the movie has been playing in some capacity or another since September, basically, when it premiered at TIFF, and word out of it has been very good. We posted a very positive review, and other critics who I trust were saying kind things, and in those reviews, the way they described it was, I think, diligently not to go in knowing a lot. Go in just kind of aware of the concept and maybe aware of some of the influences it takes, and then just see where it follows from there. And thus, I was ready to be surprised, and I was surprised by it in many respects. You know, even as someone who found Submarine impeccably composed, and also composed with a certain verve and a wit, and this willingness to always try new things, but not try new things for the sake of trying them, but to sort of build upon what had come before, I was very satisfied with what Ayoade did here, because I think it's following in that same vein. Really, from the first shot, the movie is clearly trying something outside normal bounds. It opens on a shot of Jesse Eisenberg's face, his eyes closed, he's in a train car, and there's just this light flashing by in the background, and he's rocking back and forth, and he clearly looks displeased. And there, a man says to him, "You're in my place." And his response is, "Excuse me." He says, "You're in my place." And he motions for him to get up, to move away from a seemingly innocuous seat in a completely empty train car. And the movie's kind of teeing itself up there in ways that seem obvious. The idea of a doppelganger story starting with a character being told, "You're in my place."
Yeah.
And yet, the sequence itself goes relatively unexplained as to what exactly is happening, except that it establishes character very succinctly, I think. This very nebbish type who's completely displeased with everything in his life, which is a fusion of both the screenplay and also Eisenberg's performance. And from there, I was kind of hooked. And I think that, yeah, I mean, the movie that follows is really, really almost unbearably melancholy. It's as funny as pretty much any film I've seen this year. Weirdly enough, I think the two funniest movies I've seen this year are The Double and Nymphomaniac, both of which are about finding humor in the horrors of life.
Yeah, I can see that.
And
I would also put in the Lego Movie, but I don't know if you saw that. Oh, you did see that.
We reviewed that, yeah.
Yeah, I always just assume that you miss all like the fun mainstream films.
No, I saw that. But and yet at the same time, the movie keeps, again, it keeps building on itself and it keeps evolving. And eventually the movie becomes a tragedy that is kind of about the trauma of the first half of the movie. It's sort of about when that facade comes crumbling down. And in this instance, it's a double, which is bringing it about. It's a double, which is kind of breaking apart a life piece by piece. And I think that a lot of people would be well advised to search for significance in the film as to what exactly that means and what certain clues will lead us to. And I think the movie by the end, I have an idea as to what is that exactly is going on in this film by the end of it, even if it doesn't state it so clearly. But for me, the movie was just operating on this current of emotional truth more than anything else, where I just kind of, like Submarine, I found the movie very uncomfortable because I kind of felt like I've been in this character's shoes before. It felt too real, it felt too accurate for a film that is existing in sort of this netherworld that is clearly inspired by the likes of Orson Welles' The Trial and some classics of Eastern European cinema, some Czech films, I think. There's a very sort of Czech New Wave feel to the movie's humor and its use of place. Sort of this very dark, this is a very dark setting, visually dark, literally dark, where there is no sunlight, and also this feeling of, I suppose, an industry working against you, actual industrial setting sort of weighing you down personally. And this, I think, is another example of sort of this intricate, seemingly ostentatious design feeding into a larger narrative and feeding into sort of a larger sense of place and a larger sense of feeling, which is to say nothing of Jesse Eisenberg's performance, which I think, weirdly enough, I mean, people will compare it to Annie, but for me, the comparison is actually Youth in Revolt with Michael Cera.
Okay, I can see
which
that.
Comes up in part because there's the whole comparison between Michael Cera and Jesse Eisenberg, which Jesse Eisenberg has said before he finds very irritating. But that definitely came to mind, sort of not exactly two sides of the same coin, but these two people who seemingly couldn't be more different, and yet who you're always able to see as kind of part of the same continuum. I mean, I thought it was a really terrific piece of work, maybe his best performance yet, really. Which maybe he's kind of given an advantage because he has to play two roles. But, I mean, overall, if I'm kind of just jumping all over, it's because I just watched the movie less than 24 hours ago, and it left a pretty big impression on me. I'm not 100% sure if I completely loved it. I think that maybe it gets a bit manic toward the end, a little too manic for its own good. Because to me, the best scenes in the movie are just kind of people talking with each other. And when it veers into some psychological territory, it might be a little shakier there. But where it ends up, I think, is a really powerful place. And so the approach is ultimately justified. So in short, to finally let someone else speak, I'm a big fan of this film.
All right. Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah, I think I was maybe a little more mixed. But I'm sort of hesitant to commit because I just watched the movie like this afternoon, and I think it was my first time watching a screener on DAX. And so for such a visually stimulating film, the kind of watermarks were really annoying.
I spent the $7 for it.
You did?
Yeah.
I would have been happy to see it in the theater, but the only theater it was playing in New York didn't have MoviePass. So I need to be able to use MoviePass. But anyway.
MoviePass. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful service.
Great service.
I actually need to get that because they finally started using some theaters that are actually near me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you'd be able to take advantage. I might have to check in on that. Anyway.
I recommend it. Yeah.
MoviePass.com. Anyway.
Yeah, so definitely not ideal conditions to see a movie like this. But nevertheless, I was very impressed by the look of the film. And just, it seems to exist out of time. I read a couple interviews with Ayodi where he says his sort of intent was to make it look like the future, but from the past. So I think he said something like what someone in the 50s or 60s would have thought 2014 would have looked like. And you can see the kind of the influence of that idea on stuff like the really big computers and just like this awkward technological equipment that doesn't seem like it should exist in a sort of dystopian, semi-futuristic place. So the whole environment's just out of whack and very striking. And as Nick brought up, the kind of darkness of it is really interesting. But I think as someone who also liked Submarine and was kind of impressed by that film's energy, I found this film kind of surprisingly grim, and I thought it was weighed down by this kind of sense of fatalism. And it felt a little bit stifling underneath that tone, and it was a little surprising coming after Submarine. Like, I wanted more humor. And it was definitely there in moments, and a lot of it was sort of admirably visual humor and not just sort of reliant on one-liners or anything like that. But the whole tone of it just seems from the opening minutes to be so grim that it kind of took a lot of the energy out for the movie for me. And I also don't know how convincing I found Eisenberg's interpretation of the womanizer half of his persona. And I wonder if part of me thinks he might be kind of like poking fun at his own persona in that performance. But I found a lot of the character traits there just kind of broad and not very interesting. Like, I was kind of hoping for more ambiguity between the two roles. And yeah, so I think overall I'm mixed on the film, but I don't want to commit either way because there's a lot of impressive stuff in there.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I enjoyed this movie. Let me rephrase that. I guess was going to relate to something else. So I'll just say I enjoyed this movie full stop. Eisenberg is always a good presence to have around. He's very magnetic. I mean, there's a reason that he was so good as Zuckerberg. There's a reason that he was great in Zombieland. Literally, I don't know. Let's talk about Adventureland. That was a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's good. He's great. I like having him around. He's the perfect person to play the kind of put-upon guy. I will agree with Danny that his alter ego isn't, like, a lot. It isn't very convincing. And I don't understand some of their interaction towards the second act of the movie, just on a story level. Other than that, the nice original Eisenberg is just so put upon that he'll just do whatever. The movie reminded me stylistically of Dark City.
Okay, I haven't seen that.
It's the same kind of, it like takes...
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it takes like old-time trappings and then updates them enough that they seem present, but present as imagined by someone from those old settings. There were moments that I really liked. I just don't know that it all hangs together as a whole. And I don't know if that's trouble with the script or trouble with the editing. I mean, when I saw the two Jakes in Enemy, I was able to get a very clear picture of those people. And maybe it's just because their world is at least more of a direct lineup with our own. And I had trouble just with this society and finding my way into it. I don't know. There was something about this movie that kept me on the outside. And from seeing it as anything other than a fun little romp, like, I couldn't find any of the deeper things that I was able to find in Enemy. As anyone who remembers me having a small aneurysm while talking about that movie can attest, I found a lot of stuff in Enemy. And in this, it was just a little all... It was all a little more surface and a little more cartoonish. And I still liked it. I think it's a step down from Submarine. But, you know, generally enjoyable. There were some things that are, like, really heavy-handedly set up, but I think, again, that that's part... I mean, like, the entire concept of the movie is a very heavy-handed thing. And I think that that's just something that people have to, you know, kind of get used to. That's just... Apparently both of these movies have some very heavy-handed plot points. And, yeah, that's the way it is. That's where we're at. I don't know. Maybe when we talk about it more in spoilers, I'll be able to bounce off of the things that you all are saying, but, like... If someone were to come up to me and say, hey, the double, yes or no, I'd go, yeah, sure, why not? It's not like how I was harassing people to go see Enemy. and how I will be harassing people to go see Locke. It's not a bad film. It's just kind of, you know, it's fine.
See,
it's all right.
I liked Enemy a lot, and I feel like comparisons between the two movies aren't really that apt because
I'm not comparing them like one did something else better.
Right.
I'm just saying, like, if I am looking at two Blu-rays, like, you know, Face Off or Nonstop, I'll go with Face Off. They're mm-hmm. not the same movie. But if I have a choice between the two of them, I will select one because I feel as though whatever it was trying to do, it did better, or I will get more out of it.
But I would choose the double, personally, because for me, I guess I just found much more... I guess I just found much more resonance in the tale, personally, and I also found more immediate visual inspiration, which isn't to say Enemy isn't a well-directed film. It's just that, for me, The Double was a really sort of wonderfully overpowering experience of design and of just kind of a particular kinetic visual approach that, to me, again, did not feel really overwhelming or anything. I mean, the comparison that's been raised, actually, by Eddie himself is Martin Scorsese's After Hours, which is actually probably my favorite Scorsese film. And so that comparison kind of should tell you that I am very, you know, predisposed toward a movie that will use that as an inspiration. And I mean, to me, the movies are kind of similar in the sense that... how would I put it? There's this very, for me, this is very tight, very sort of interlocking sensation to the screenplay. And yet there's also kind of the sense of, you know, not really questioning events themselves because a lot of it feels kind of coincidence driven. And a lot of it feels this, you know, again, almost like the horror of life in a way. Just sort of this way that these things can kind of happen and you sort of have to deal with them. And the way The Double kind of works off of that, I guess I just found something about it kind of continually hypnotic in a way.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I was drawn in the entire time,
mm-hmm.
but I found it more hypnotic in not so much a psychological way as in more of like an aesthetic and narrative way.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I guess, yeah, emotionally, I just found that there was a current to it that had a lot of, as anybody who has seen the Coen Brothers' short world cinema will know, there's a hell of a lot of truth to it. That's what I was kind of thinking to myself throughout. And, I mean, kind of the center of the film, as in Submarine, is a romantic attachment that is frustratingly unrequited, or rather unrequited because the main character is, you know, too much of a sissy to do anything about it.
Yeah. And we'll get into the romantic elements in this film later. For me, anyway.
Again, it's about how you can have this world that, you know, looks like the future as envisioned by the past, and yet you can still ground those things in a certain reality. And you can also work in a joke about two men on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
That is probably the funniest line I've heard in a movie this year. I don't know. Something about that line in particular.
There's a certain truth to it.
And it's also, I mean, it's part of a smaller piece of this movie's intricate build where, you know, for some reason his womanizing side is also kind of like a raging homophobe, which I think is an interesting component to a film that is about a man who is, you know, experiencing another version of himself,
basically.
And that the movie doesn't really explain it, that the movie doesn't really feel the need to go into it and psychoanalyze it too much, I really appreciated. It just kind of leaves it there and sort of lets it sit. And how it lets it sit is key. I think the movie is very good at both providing something very elaborate and also providing something very kind of broad and vague and allowing us to dive into it a bit ourselves after the fact. That has as much to do with the screenplay as it does AOD's direction, but to me they're sort of synonymous in a lot of ways. I felt like there was a good harmony at play there. Yes.
And, Danny, any thoughts before we get into the spoiler section?
I'd be willing just to dive in getting spoilers would be easier.
Okay, so that's our thoughts on The Devil. It's out now on VOD as well as in limited release, so check it out if you like. So spoilers for The Devil. Where do we want to start? We talked about The Women not too long ago. I want to talk about a similarity in this film that I could not get away from Enemy. Aside from, oh god, there's doppelgangers, and one of them is like a more masculine guy, more forceful, and the other one's easily pushed around and has a really terrible time talking to people. The big similarity for me is the fact that their winning of this game of existence seems to, in both cases, come down to who is with what woman. In this, however, there is like a literal kind of woman who seems to work as the prize medal. And I don't know how I feel about that. It's just, I don't know. Like, there's got to be another way for a movie to to do this, right? You know, like, I understand that it's difficult to, in a film, in a visual medium, to express the existential anguish of having someone else steal your life or your desired life away from you. But it just really struck me weirdly in this movie how Mia Wasikowska plays this woman who is the endgame. Because in Enemy, both men had a woman that they were with. And the women had agency in the situation. We won't go into spoilers for that. But if you see that movie, you will understand what I'm saying. And in this film, she is not seemingly imbued with any agency. There's a scene towards the end of the movie where she has a miscarriage, presumably from bad Jesse Eisenberg, and then tries to commit suicide. And then she's pissed off when the other guy saves her, and then he tries to commit suicide towards the end, or, you know, at least wants to grievously wound himself. And she climbs into the ambulance with him, and that's kind of like, he's won. Did anyone else have trouble with this? Or see it and think that it was, like, vaguely troubling?
What did you find troubling?
I just hate that her affections were the goal, were the winning. Like, she's not... There's something about a person being reduced to a win chip in a movie that I don't like that much. And I feel like she is, you know, the pretty popular girl in a high school 80s movie, where if the nerd just socks her jock boyfriend, then you know that he's done the right thing because suddenly she likes him.
I don't know if that's exactly it, though. I mean, I don't know. To me, the scenario that you're providing as an alternative seems so different to what this film is doing.
But I mean, if that's the case, should the film have tried to maybe not do something else, but just reposition her in some way?
I mean, I think so. For me, my biggest problem with the film is that something about the romantic affections as they're positioned aren't actually that interesting. I think because the idea of a double sort of stepping in and taking over a romantic life and going after the girl that he always wanted feels kind of expected. And it's one of the few components of the film that to me feels expected. It's one of the few components that feels familiar. Almost as if, you know, if you were to have like 10 people write a story with this kind of template, like 8 of them would go in that direction.
Oh, yeah,
probably.
Absolutely. Well, it's like, how is this guy losing agency? Like, how is this man losing agency? One of them is his job, which, yes, that makes sense. Like, someone is stealing his ideas, his intellectual property, and assuming his life at his job. That works. The other is that he's doing things that are criminal that he knows he can pass off on the other guy. That's, again, hijacking your agency. As you can tell from this review and the last review, I love looking at people and the exercising of agency. And I don't feel like the female character portrayed by Mia Wasikowska, is given agency. She's just another token of the agency of the male characters. So I that was my most troubling part. And at the end, aside from just, I guess, maybe general confusion at the end, but we can get into that when we talk about it more. Nick, you were saying something about my issues with the... I think you were kind of agreeing with me?
Well, yes.
Okay.
No, just because for me, the movie does a very fine job of, again, building this world and building this mood in a, you know, quote-unquote original fashion. And I don't know. Yeah, I guess just where it kind of, you know, to kind of angle toward that, to angle toward it is problematic for me. But I like how the movie winds up resolving itself. I like how it kind of circles back. I think that circling back is, in fact, very appropriate for a film that deals with this kind of subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my problem with it is sort of glided over a bit because of where it ends up. It's the destination, not the journey in this case. I suppose it's something like that, which I don't, is not how I always feel when I'm watching a film. But in this case, I feel like the through line is on point enough to make that work. I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't really feel that compelled to defend it as much as I liked it, and I did like it very much, just because I can understand why someone would not really see it as completely their thing, or they would find issues with the direction it takes. To me, that makes sense. So,
all right, that makes sense. And so, at the end of the film, good Jesse Eisenberg. I don't want to put this. He discovers that any harm visited upon himself shall be visited back upon himself. He hits his doppelganger in the face, and they both get broken noses. And so then he handcuffs his doppelganger to his bed, his own bed. Good Jesse Eisenberg handcuffs bad Jesse Eisenberg to good Jesse Eisenberg's bed, and then goes and jumps out of a window, because previously another man had done this, and a pair of cops had comically pointed out that if the guy had jumped from like 2 feet to the left, he would have hit an awning that would have bounced him and probably saved his life, so long as the ambulance got there fast enough. So from what I can tell, looking at this film, the implication is that he committed half suicide so that his doppelganger, who is incapable of going and getting help or calling for help, will die because he is not getting medical attention.
So it's Fight Club.
A little bit, yeah.
Wow. That's kind of what I thought of.
I thought of it as, there's a joke. And it's a woman who recently went through a divorce finds, like, a genie on a golf course or something. Like, she's out with her friends as they find a genie. And the woman who recently went through the divorce, and her husband's an asshole, and the genie says, I'm going to grant you, like, 3 wishes, but everything that you get, your husband's going to get 2 of. Like, he's going to get double as much. And so she's like, I want, you know, $100 million. And the genie's like, your asshole piece of shit ex-husband is going to get $200 million. She's like, that's fine. She's like, and I want a huge yacht. Yeah, big yacht. And the genie says, your husband's going to get 2 big yachts. And she says, yeah, that's fine. And then the genie says, okay, one more wish. Again, stipulation. Asshole X is going to get twice as much as whatever you get. She says, I would love if on the way home, someone beat me half to death.
Oh, that's nice.
Right?
Wow, great joke.
Right, it's a good joke. Anyway, that's what I saw in this film. I was like, oh, this is the existential manifestation of that joke. So yeah, that's what I saw it as. I'm glad I was able to work a minuscule joke onto this podcast. And we're to assume, I'd like to ask you this question, Nick. What did you read into the very forceful eye closing at the end of this film?
Well, why are you asking me specifically?
I don't know.
Okay.
Because you didn't get to talk in Locke, so I'm just trying to give you the most airtime.
Sure.
Nice guy. I'll get to Danny, don't worry.
Well, I think that the eye closing is basically ending something. I think that it is, in fact, his way of kind of taking control. And it mirrors the opening shot, obviously,
right,
where
obviously
he has his eyes closed.
Yeah.
Because it starts with his eyes opening, it ends with his eyes closing. And I think that part of it is that sort of what I took from it was that he finds himself so miserable inside this world, and he's kind of inflicting this misery upon himself in a lot of ways. And after he has finally committed what is basically the worst sort of infliction one could commit, he is kind of ready to not necessarily close himself off, but he's ready to take a bit of command. It took something, again, as you had said, it took something as extreme as jumping off a building and killing part of yourself. And so I think that when he's closing his eyes, he's sort of preparing himself for a new stage, essentially. Yeah, I mean, that was, I guess I thought, I don't know. To me, the shot was kind of self-evident in its meaning. That's just what I immediately took from it.
It was just so, like, I guess it was just so, like, forceful. It's like when a little kid pretends to go to sleep. You know what I'm talking about? Is anyone, when you were a kid and your parents, like,
yeah,
go to sleep,
yeah,
and you'd, like, rapidly shut your eyes and you'd almost, like, tuck your head forward. And you'd be like, yeah, this is it. I'm asleep. It's over. Do you think that that's... Does anyone... So, when he kills his other self, I mean, he still has no job. Like, he didn't get anything back, right? All he got back was that he's the only one of himself, right? Because there were some random insert shots of him, like, nicking his double like he had been nicked, and, like, taking a key and, like, the card that he has at work from his double. Was there any idea in your head that he was going to try to assume his double's life, at least for work, because he'd actually earned it, and he was going to live life outside of work as himself?
Was that ever presented as a distinct possibility for him?
I don't know. I mean,
because the movie kind of plays it as... I mean, one of the jokes in it is that nobody really... nobody can really tell a difference between them, you know? I mean, there's the one person played by Noah Taylor,
yeah,
who kind of has that reaction and goes, it looks a lot like you. Man, that's kind of fucked up, isn't it?
yeah, but I mean, I think the thing is that, like, if he were to... I think that the statement that the movie is making there is they're so not alike personally that no one would ever think that they were the same physically. So maybe, like, if he goes into work and he's like, hey, I'm this great guy who has all this shit going on. Maybe it's just that I really want him to succeed in that way, because I was just so furious throughout the entire film whenever he was getting, like, really, like, obviously dicked over. I don't know. Danny, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I feel like the movie, you know, could have gone in that direction. Like, this character, his arc is, like, he assumes the evil side of his double, and that's where he goes. But I feel like it sort of cuts down that possibility, maybe in the scene where he's been set up on a date with Wasikowska's character, and he has, like, an earpiece in, and he's being told what to say, but he just can't do it. So I feel like it kind of proves pretty early that isn't going to work for him. And so I didn't really think it would go there, like, in the future after the film ended. But I guess one more thing
you wouldn't have thought that he'd jump out a window either, so.
No, I would. One more thing that I could add to the conversation, I think, is that, and this brings back to what we were talking about the female character, is I think that's sort of, like, on a plot level, Aody's main addition to the story, because I think I read the novella, like, several months ago, and I'm pretty sure there's not kind of, like, a through-line love interest like that.
I mean, it's Dostoevsky, right? I mean, he could give a shit about love.
Yeah, it's not that kind of...
Seeing this movie and knowing it was from a novella by Dostoevsky, I was like, oh, this is going to be a laugh riot. This is going to be fantastic.
But so I think that is, like, maybe the most uneven part of the movie, but it sort of introduces this interesting voyeurism aspect that isn't really in the book and is sort of seems obviously indebted to, like, Hitchcock and De Palma. And the score, which I actually really liked, I think the score was one of my favorite aspects of the movie felt like a kind of crazy score from a De Palma thriller. And the scenes of him just looking through the telescope just did bring this like weird interest in voyeurism to the story. But I think that what AOD does most successfully is capture Dostoevsky's sense of like the tyranny of the workplace and that institutionalization, and like the scene where we were talking about where his coworker was like, yeah, man, that's fucked up. You guys look alike, but like, I don't really give a shit either way. It's sort of like, that's the spirit of that workplace. And I think AOD captures that really well. And then, yeah, maybe the ending like does go a bit off the rails because I don't even really have a better interpretation of it. I think you guys have done a good enough job of saying what the hell happened there.
All right. Well, any other final thoughts on this before we go into the week ahead?
I wish I had seen it kind of on a bigger screen than my TV.
Yeah.
Although I did watch it in HD. I just, you know, I found the film so beautiful. And so the production design I found very intoxicating. So if I could have seen it there, that would have been nice. But it is on VOD. It's only $7. So
check it out.
Yeah, if you want to see it, it's right there, which is nice. I remember having to wait kind of a while for Submarine. So just a few years later, we've come so far.
I know. It's pretty crazy. I'll say that there was a plot point in this movie that made me think of something else, and it's when good Jesse Eisenberg. We haven't been using the characters' names because the characters' names are James Simon and Simon James. So I feel like just saying good Jesse Eisenberg and bad Jesse Eisenberg are basically a lot easier than trying to figure out if we're using last names or first names. Something that the movie does to great effect sometimes as well. So what I was going to say is that there's a scene where good Jesse Eisenberg is told that he no longer exists in the system. They've already cut up his card because the card was like corrupted and he was accidentally deleted from the system and he can't be put back in the system because he doesn't have a card to prove that he was in the system. And just that kind of crazy bureaucratic insanity, it really made me think of... Oh, shit, what's it called? Oh, it really made me think of a TV show I once watched called Better Off Ted, which I believe is on Netflix now. And it's about a guy who works at, like, a hilariously evil corporation. And they have a plot, like, in an episode that's like that, where his name card is wrong. It's like his last name is Crisp and it's Chips on his name card. And so he goes to get it fixed and everyone just keeps calling him by his new name. And then when the person in HR finally believes him, they delete him from the system and they can't put him back in because the name card says that he's someone else. And then when they do finally put him back in the system, he actually has to reapply for his own job because he's technically been fired because they deleted his name. But then they're not going to give him his job back because he has so much experience that they'd have to pay him more to hire him back. And so they're just going to hire a cheaper guy. So if you're a fan of crazy-ass workplace, like, bureaucratic, you know, you're a small cog in a machine and no one cares about you, stuff like that, Better Off Ted. Hilarious show. Unappreciated in its time. All right, so let's move on to the week ahead. Coming to Blu-ray and DVD. Actually, you know what? You know what? Before we do that, y'all have waited long enough, and we're about to talk about Blu-rays and DVDs, so what a great time to give away some! First, I'd like to congratulate the winner of the contest that we made for A Touch of Sin. And this was, for anyone who doesn't remember, you had to go on, follow us, and retweet the tweet that we sent out that was literally saying, retweet this to win. So, pretty simple. And that is John Gilpatrick on Twitter, at John L. Gilpatrick. John, congratulations, you have won. To claim your prize, email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Be warned, if you don't email us in a proper amount of time, we will give it to someone else. Because we are evil. We'll probably also tweet at you, but you do have to email us because we need to be able to figure out where the hell to send this thing to. So John Gilpatrick, congratulations. We had a massive turnout for this, and so we're doing it again. New contest. First Blu-ray we're giving out is a re-release of Fargo. Fargo on Blu-ray. Opportune timing, because there is an FX show based off of Fargo. That's actually... I've seen the pilot. It's pretty good. I haven't seen the rest of it because I'm lazy. So, Fargo Blu-ray. How do you win? Again, follow us on Twitter. There will be a contest tweet, and all you have to do is retweet it and respond to the tweet with your favorite Coen Brothers film. There are no wrong answers, but we will be judging you. So again, follow us on Twitter, look for the tweet, retweet it, and respond back with your favorite Coen Brothers film, and you could win the Fargo Blu-ray. As for the Blu-ray for Grand Piano, all you'll have to do is retweet. Again, follow us on Twitter. Follow us on Twitter, retweet, you could win the Grand Piano Blu-ray. I know a bunch of you are asking yourselves, Brian, what on earth is Grand Piano? Let me tell you. This is actually an interesting film that I really want to see. It stars Elijah Wood as a person who is a piano player, and there's a note in his sheet music that says if he plays a single wrong note, he's going to die. How cool is that? This is apparently a very visually stunning movie, on top of its bananas idea for a plot. So if you'd like to be able to win this and then tell us how it is, unless we somehow see it before you, follow us on Twitter, retweet, and you could be selected for Grand Piano. All of these contests are good through the 18th of May, this Sunday. So get on that shit. Retweet us and respond to us by the 18th, and you could win. Listen to the show to hear your name, and then email us, and we'll work on getting those to you. Winners will be announced during the next podcast. What are we listening to, or what are we going to talk about on the next podcast? Stay tuned to find out. So, what is coming out on Blu-ray today? Because we were late. On Blu-ray, we have Her, a movie that we all quite liked. We also have I, Frankenstein. Did anyone see this?
No.
No, I didn't. I didn't see that film.
Nick, I asked just so I could hear you say it like that. We also have the Oceans Trilogy Collection. We also have Orange is the New Black. Overlord, a very good film, is being released on Criterion Blu-ray. Stalingrad 3D, which I really wanted to see and I didn't get a chance to, so kind of happy about that, actually. Also, That Awkward Moment, starring Zac Efron and Michael B. Jordan, as well as Miles Teller. Strangers on a Train... by a lake. Stranger by the Lake. And yeah, there's a lot of other stuff coming out, but I feel like that's pretty much the biggest stuff. Gentlemen, amongst these, any thoughts on what you think people should check out?
I still have not seen Stranger by the Lake, but I'm very excited to. So that is a top priority for me.
Yeah, I really want to see Stranger by the Lake. I also want to buy Her immediately. And I still want to see Stalingrad, so I'm going to do that. Danny King?
Yeah, Stranger by the Lake is quite a good work of cinema, so check it out. I think there's also a film called Two Road Together that's coming out on Blu-ray that's supposed to be kind of an overlooked John Ford gem, so I've been meaning to see that for a while.
All right, excellent. Coming this week to theaters... Godzilla. I have seen it. I don't have a review up for it yet. However, there is a review at thefilmstage.com. Has been for a while, so if you haven't checked that out, read it and see if you should see this movie. I will tell you right now that I think that you ought to.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say anything on that, because then you won't have a reason to come back next week. Nick and Danny, you will be seeing this, and we will be talking about it, correct?
I believe that's the plan.
Good. I'm actually eager to hear what you all think of this film.
Ooh.
I think that, you know, in the terms of the big Hollywood action blockbusters that we've been enduring the last couple of years, I think that this movie will be a catalyst for us to talk about a lot of the trends we've seen, and it'll be a really good conversation, I feel. I think that both formally, narratively, and everything else, this'll be a movie that's actually got some things to talk about. So Godzilla, coming next week, not even next week, coming out May 16th, this coming Friday. Check it out, and then come here to listen to us talk about it. Also coming out, Million Dollar Arm. Okay, this is another one of those films. I don't understand the plot. It's based on a true story, right?
Pretty sure.
And so, like, this guy, he's a baseball recruiter, and I guess that they get some kind of money for if they find someone. So he's like, what can I do? Oh, I'll go to India and find a cricket player and teach him to pitch. And so that's... like, I guess I just don't get it. Like, why, like, couldn't he just find someone in America? Anyway, I've heard decent-ish things about this, so I'm looking forward to hearing other things and probably seeing it when it's on HBO. Also coming out in limited release, we have The Immigrant, the newest film by James Gray. Nick Newman, I believe that you have an interview with Mr. Gray on the site right now.
Yes, that's correct. It's a very long interview. It's actually the longest interview I've ever done, I believe. The final... excepting my introduction, the final word count was a little over... it was about 3,800 words.
So you recorded this and you transcribed it by hand?
I mean, I transcribed it. Typed it.
Okay, yeah, I'm just saying, like, you didn't give it to an agency or use... like,
No, I just transcribed it myself.
That's crazy. Why did you not give us the audio to put on a special edition of the Film Stage Show?
We can play the audio if you want. You could do both. It
That'll just
really...
be our entire review. We've done that before.
Hey, I've got the audio right on my computer here, so...
All right, well, we'll talk to Jordan about it. Anyway, so that's what's coming out next week. There's a bunch of other smaller films that are coming out. Chinese Puzzle, Half a Yellow Sun, Ai Weiwei, The Fake Case. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, so that's all happening. So now it's time for our personal selections. Because this has been a supersized episode yet again, they will be insanely brief. As in, title of movie and single line convincing someone to see it. Danny King, set a good precedent.
Yeah, well, this works out because I had kind of a funny one prepared anyway. Because I've been busy, so I haven't seen a lot of new stuff. But I did see Transcendence.
Oh, God.
The directorial debut of Wally Pfister. And it is kind of a disaster, as you've probably heard. But the one thing I will say about it is, like, it's really interesting to watch a $100 million film that's made by someone who has no idea how to direct actors. And it makes for an amazingly awkward movie because there's not a single scene where any actor seems convinced by what they're doing or even vaguely confident that they're sort of pulling it off. It's just like, it's such a mess. And I imagine even something like Amazing Spider-Man 2, I imagine you could call like a decently acted movie.
Yeah, I would say that.
Just because Mark Webb probably knows how that goes down. But like,
those are the best parts of the film, the interpersonal stuff. So, yeah.
But if you're watching Transcendence and you have actors like Johnny Depp, Rebecca Hall, Morgan Freeman, Cillian Murphy, it's so rare to like see them in a situation where they have no idea what they're doing. And it seems like everything they know about acting has just been thrown out the window. So if that sounds like...
that appeals to you.
Yeah, if that sounds like it appeals to you, check it out. But it's a very bad movie.
All right, that was not one sentence. Nick Newman, see if you can do this.
I watched La Cienega, directed by Lucretia Martel.
La Cienega?
Cienega, The Swamp.
Okay, yeah, La Cienega.
Directed by Lucretia Martel from 2001. I actually had to watch it for one of my final assignments for a class of mine, but the film was nevertheless a pleasure. Okay, this is going to be a colon in the sentence.
Okay.
So it's still one sentence. very visually opulent and kind of this mysterious character piece that disregards pretty much all notions of plot and connectivity in favor of tone and mood. M-dash. Overall, something I would recommend very highly.
All right.
That's one sentence. That's probably too long a sentence, but...
You would get yelled at for an English teacher, but because of your punctuation, you technically made it a sentence. So we'll stick with it. I watched James Mangold's 3:10 to Yuma, starring Russell Crowe and Christian Bale. I own that movie. A rip-roaring adventure yarn that is big fun for the whole family. Full stop.
Very good. Yeah.
Sweet. Anyway, that's it. That's it. That's all for today. We are leaving you now. Tune in next week when we'll talk about Godzilla. In the meantime, to sate your thirst for Godzilla-related opinions, go to the film stage where we have a review up. Also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We will be having the giveaways of Grand Piano and Fargo, so keep an eye out for those. Tweet liberally at us. Let us know what you thought of the show. Let us know what you think Godzilla will be like. Or, hey, if you see Godzilla Friday or Saturday, chances are we're going to record on Sunday. So shoot us your opinions, and we will read them on the air. As always, rate us on iTunes. Give us a comment. Let us know how we're doing. And don't be afraid to go on thefilmstage.com and find the post for this podcast and leave a comment there as well. Gentlemen, let's tell the people where we can be found. Nick Newman.
Thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
Danny King.
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
You can find me on my personal site, dearfilm.net. You can also find me on thefilmstage.com and finally twitter.com/Brian J. Rowan. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again. Tune in next week when we will talk about Godzilla, the King of the Monsters. We'll also be looking at Richard Ayoade's newest film.
Ayoade.
Ayoade?
Like peyote?
But Ayoade?
Ayoade, yes.
Okay. A Fargo as well as a Blu-ray. Why am I having so much trouble with that word? And that is... What the hell is that noise? Has anyone listening to music? The trends that we've seen... I'm sorry, my dog appears to be attacking a receipt that's on the floor. Decent-ish things. Lana, please calm down.